It is Tuesday, March 8th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, it's another big day for U.S. Republican and Democratic presidential contenders who face voters in four states. We'll find out what to expect with our national correspondent, Jim Malone. We've got breaking news from our Pentagon reporter on the fate of a high-profile Islamic State militant targeted by a U.S.-led airstrike in Syria. And we'll hear from two women's rights advocates from Africa and India about the challenges facing women around the world as they mark International Women's Day. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, voters are heading to primaries and caucuses in four U.S. states on Tuesday in the next stage of the race for the U.S. presidency. Republicans and Democrats vying to be their party's presidential nominees face voters in Michigan and Mississippi, while two other states are holding contests for the Republicans only, Idaho, and Hawaii. Our national correspondent, Jim Malone, joins me now in the studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Michael.
Well, how big a test is today for the Republican Party establishment that is trying to prevent Donald Trump from getting closer to the nomination?
It could be an important test. What they're trying to see is if Trump is losing momentum. And we'll be looking at that primarily in two states, Mississippi, he's done very well in the South, by the way, and in Michigan, the first big industrial state to vote on the primary calendar so far. Michigan offers an opportunity for John Kasich, the Ohio governor, to try to make a play. He apparently has been coming on the polls a bit. Whether it's enough to sort of threaten Trump, we don't know. And then we have the situation between Trump and Ted Cruz. They'll be most competitive in Mississippi. Trump barely won over Cruz in Louisiana over the weekend, so there's some question about how well he'll do in Mississippi.
Well, regarding Michigan, Trump has been shown to be ahead in several recent polls. Does it matter how much Donald Trump would win Michigan by, or just winning would be enough for him, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not clear. If it's very close, I think it would play into the narrative that Trump is losing steam. So if Kasich or Cruz can come very close to him in Michigan, or if Trump were to lose, let's say, which the polls don't suggest that, I think moving forward, then the focus would shift to March 15th, the big primaries, five states then, as the last opportunity for the establishment to really block Trump.
Well, let's move on to the Democrats now. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, the two Democratic contenders, have been getting a little more aggressive in terms of attacking each other lately. How is that affecting the Democratic race?
Well, we'll know more, I think, with the results from Michigan. I would think Clinton would be heavily favored in Mississippi. She's done very well in the South, thanks to African-American voters. Michigan has a sizable number of African-American voters. They also have a lot of sort of white, blue-collar workers, factory workers, that kind of thing. And Sanders has done quite well with them. Michigan has a number of big universities. So the college youth vote should play in for Sanders. They had a very contentious debate the other night in Flint, Michigan, though. And I think Sanders is a bit on the defensive over a vote concerning the auto bailout. So Clinton may have had a strategic blow there. But we'll see. Sanders has been closing in the polls in Michigan. It could be a close race.
And one more thing to ask you about. We just heard from former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg that he won't be running as a third-party candidate. What do you make of that announcement?
Probably a relief for the Democrats. He probably would have taken votes away from someone like Hillary Clinton. And Bloomberg, it was very doubtful he could find a path to win the presidency as a third-party candidate. It's very difficult.
Well, thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, for bringing us the latest on those races. And I'm sure we'll check in with you again later once the results come in.
Thank you.
Well, up next, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, with us in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So we've got primaries and caucuses tonight. Why don't we start with a general picture?
Sure. So like you said earlier, the Republican Party will award 150 more delegates Tuesday night in Michigan, Mississippi, Idaho, and Hawaii. And as for Democrats, it's only Michigan and Mississippi. All eyes are on whether billionaire Donald Trump will continue to be the GOP frontrunner after receiving mixed results over the weekend. And many people are also watching whether Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders can chip away his rival's lead in Michigan. And of course, we're talking about former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And like Jim mentioned earlier, she's widely expected to win in Mississippi.
Well, how well is Donald Trump being received on Twitter today?
Well, as you know, he's very prolific on Twitter and probably has less reservations about targeting his rivals on social media than any of the other contenders in both parties. And at least on Twitter, his popularity hasn't suffered at all from that. Even simple gestures like merely repeating his campaign slogan, which is "Make America Great Again," gets retweeted more than 7,000 times and liked by more than 1,400 people within hours.
Well, regarding the latest Democratic debate, how is that going to affect the primaries tonight, do you think?
Great question. So many people agree the Democratic debate on the whole state more or less issue-oriented, and that has changed a little bit. But compared to a number of recent GOP debates, I think that's it stayed that way. But that doesn't mean people are not criticizing it at all, because Bernie Sanders is still suffering from a comment he made during the Flint debate, and he said, "When you're white, you don't know what it's like to be living in a ghetto. You don't know what it's like to be poor." Many media outlets have retweeted that, and some of the replies say that is an inaccurate information and that he's unfairly biased against white people. That's all for me today.
Okay, thanks so much, G. Well, you can follow G on Twitter. She is at G Abby Lee, and I'm on there as well. You can find me at Michael_Lippin, and of course, you can also follow this program. Its handle is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Tuberculosis, or TB, is one of the world's deadliest diseases, and estimates are that up to one-third of the world's population has the illness. There are several ways to diagnose TB, but most are time-consuming or expensive. Now, researchers at Stanford University say they've developed a blood test that could make it easier and cheaper to treat patients with tuberculosis.
Early diagnosis is critical because delays in diagnosis lead to delays in treatment, which then allow the infection to go on and spread from person to person more readily.
Dr. Mandad Norsaday with the University College London says there's a lot of interest in an effective blood test for TB, which could help identify people with the illness at earlier stages if further testing proves the Stanford test to be valuable. Tuberculosis mostly burdens poor countries, but it also takes a toll on densely populated cities across the globe. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. A red-bearded Islamic State commander described by American officials as the group's de facto minister of war may have been killed in a U.S.-led coalition airstrike in Syria. For more on this developing story, I'm joined on the line by our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Michael. Yes, very exciting news coming out of here.
Yeah, what can you tell us about this commander? What's his name and where is he from?
Well, he's got a couple of names. He's been called Tarkan Batyrshavli, he's been called Abu Omar al-Shashani, but the best way to know him is Omar the Chechen. He was, the commander was supposed to be and believed to be in this al-Shanati area due to recent successes against the group by the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. We have been told, reporters here at the Pentagon have been told just recently by Colonel Garver out of Baghdad that the Syrian Democratic Forces had gained about 2,600 square kilometers recently, bringing the total amount much higher than what had been announced in December. Back then, the U.S. was saying that they had been gaining about 300, 400 square kilometers. So massive gains in this desert area recently had sent Omar the Chechen to the area, according to U.S. officials. And then the official told me that he was there to assess the strength of the Islamic State troops, try to figure out what was going on, try to boost morale, and the U.S. decided that the coalition would take the strike.
Well, what more do we know about the significance of this Islamic State commander to that militant group?
Well, as you mentioned, he was kind of heading the war front for the Islamic State. The United States, in fact, had put a $5 million reward on this guy. They said he was closely coordinating with the Islamic State's financial section, and a lot of people have said that he was very, very close to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and that that he was relying very heavily on Omar the Chechen to kind of run the war front. So this is a huge loss. You've seen losses on the recruitment front for the Islamic State. You've seen losses in the cyber front. And now we're starting to see a massive war loss if he is indeed dead. But U.S. officials are not claiming victory yet. Let's be clear. They said he was the target of the strike and that there were up to 12 Islamic State fighters that were killed in that strike. They still don't know if one of those killed was Omar the Chechen.
All right, and just very quickly, how does that process work of establishing whether he was in fact killed?
Well, that's where you have to deal with your ISR, which is intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. You have to use some of your sources in the area. Remember, the United States only has about 50 military special ops forces in there kind of coordinating with the Syrian Democratic Forces, reaching out to some of the Kurds in the area, trying to keep them coordinated on their attacks against the Islamic State. So it's a very hard, long, difficult process.
Okay.
In fact, it could be weeks before we'd ever know.
Well, thanks so much, Carla Babb, our Pentagon correspondent, bringing us the latest on the outcome of that U.S.-led coalition airstrike in Syria. Thank you, Carla.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, it is International Women's Day, that is Tuesday, March 8th, and it was the subject of our hashtag VOA program today. We had two guests on the show, Amira Woods, an African affairs expert with the Institute of Policy Studies here in Washington. We also had a guest via Skype from New Delhi in India, Reena Simone Khanna, an Indian TV news anchor. Well, here is host Mil Arcega, and let's have a listen to the start of that program.
Amira, I want to talk to you first about equal pay for women. It remains an elusive right. You know, a recent survey that I checked out, around the world, women do 66% of the work, it says here, produce 50% of the food, and yet they earn just 10% of the worldwide income. What gives? Why is that still happening in 2016?
What gives is this major inequality that's almost baked into a global economic system that actually benefits a very narrow slice of the world. Usually the 1% is male and it's often white, right? So in this global economy, we have to recognize that there are structures that are leading to increased inequality, increased unemployment, and these issues around unequal, both unequal power distributions and unequal wages, not only in countries in the global south, but really all around the world.
I assume you're very hopeful. Otherwise, you would not be taking part in this program. I want to talk to you about some of the progress that's been made in just a little bit. But first, I want to get to Reena on the issue of violence against women. Reena, there were massive protests following the brutal rape and murder of a 23-year-old in a Delhi bus in December in 2012. And for me, it seemed to expose, in all its ugliness, this so-called rape culture that exists in many parts of the world. My question to you is a mindset towards women as second-class citizens changing in India?
Yes. Greetings from India, first of all, to all of you and all our listeners and viewers who are here. It's a very difficult question, Mel, because India, as you know, there is no single formula that can describe what India is. It's multi-layered, multi-structured, multi-cultured, and so it's difficult to figure out what is the mindset of the Indian male, if there is a mindset that can fit all. There were protests as far as violence against women is concerned. There continues to be violence against women, even today. We don't seem to be learning quickly. We don't seem to be learning at all in some cases. It's difficult, but the government is trying its best to put in programs and put in legislation which can help. But more and more we are realizing that it is women who have to take on the task of changing the minds within the family, within society, and within themselves. So we're hoping that we change.
Well, that was Indian TV news personality Reena Simone Khanna speaking with hashtag VOA host Mil Arcega. Well, you can watch more of that conversation by going to the show's website, which is voanews.com/hashtag VOA. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Iran's recent elections and the lifting of international sanctions appear to be weakening decades of conservative dominance of parliament and the council that chooses the country's supreme leader. These recent developments are also providing a fresh look at a country that has been somewhat isolated from the West. Westerners are less and less a novelty on the streets of Iranian cities, and American journalists are pouring in to Iran to assess the changes. International Edition's Peter Heinlein spoke by phone with Vivian Walt, a reporter on assignment for Fortune magazine, and she's been visiting Tehran for the first time in 10 years. In the first of three conversations with Walt, she talked about what Iranians expect and hope for the dawn of a new era.
Well, I find Tehran somewhat changed since the last time I was here, but that was nearly 10 years ago. Certainly, there is a feeling after the elections that the country is maybe inevitably heading towards a big change. The reformists, those who do not want so strict a kind of theologically based society, if you like, did an absolute clean sweep of the elections in Tehran. It appeared as if the entire city wanted a big change and was solidly behind President Rouhani's reform program. Well, and I think that that took people somewhat by surprise.
Well, what were people voting for when they voted for Rouhani, President Rouhani's allies?
Basically, what people want is to rejoin the world. I think, by and large, if you ask people at the heart of the issue, what do you want? Very few of them will say, we want better jobs or we want more money. They want to be a normal country. And I think particularly for the younger generation, which is the vast majority of this country, is younger than 35. So you have an entire nation, really, who's come of age after the revolution, which was 37 years ago. So it was a long time ago. And for these generations, they are increasingly finding ways to access the internet, to see what the rest of the world is up to on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter. Actually, all those sites are officially banned in Iran, but it appears that everybody has some ways of getting access to them. And they simply want to be part of that world. They don't want to be isolated. They don't want to be under embargo. It's not as if there are things in Iran which you cannot find. You can find almost anything. But it's a fact of being so isolated politically and of not being able to simply be a normal nation that I think has really gotten under people's skin.
And that was Vivian Walt, a reporter on assignment for Fortune magazine, speaking with International Edition's Peter Heinlein. A young South African musician is winning admirers for her fusion of tribal rhythms from around the world. Courtney Gibson blends Western instruments like electric guitar with traditional African instruments like the djembe drum and other indigenous instruments like the Australian Aboriginal didgeridoo to create exceptional sounds. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
Gibson says she uses instruments like the didgeridoo to mimic the sounds of Africa's animals, like the slow, violent growl of a lion on a nighttime hunt.
I try and pull those sounds into the didj, and the drums obviously help a lot because drums is part of Africa. The beat has got the rhythm of Africa and everything that we are.
Her love of Africa, its nature and its people, was inspired by her upbringing on a farm in the mountains of Mpumalanga province. Here, villagers taught her to make music using waste materials from a local dump.
I kind of picked up a pool pipe and started playing a pool pipe because I didn't have money for a didgeridoo, as us South Africans don't much have money, so...
As a child with pool pipe in mouth, Gibson dreamed of one day owning a real didgeridoo.
I just liked the sound, always liked the sound. I always found it had a nice tribal feel to it.
As Gibson has grown as a musician, so has her small collection of instruments. helping her create some of South Africa's most unique contemporary music. Gibson says no matter what she ever achieves as an artist, she'll never come close to her hero, the great South African folk singer and songwriter, Vusi Mahlasela.
Let's take the speed and put it right inside of this evil monster so we can learn to be free.
She recently saw Mahlasela at a festival and approached him with a request.
Can I please play you a song? And he was kind of a bit shocked. He just said, okay, play it. And I played on his guitar. And it was the most amazing thing, gave me a big hug afterwards.
Like Mahlasela, Gibson makes music with a conscience.
And how can you just sit there and say you don't know?
While most white South African musicians try to sound like American and British indie rock bands, Gibson's art remains firmly rooted in the bush of Mpumalanga.
I don't see why I should be something that I'm not. I'm African, I'm born here. My soul and everything inside me is African.
Many of her songs reflect her concern about the destruction of Africa's environment. Gibson says she doesn't want to be famous. She knows she'll never win awards playing what she calls her weird music. All that matters, she says, is that she's true to herself, true to Africa, and true to the rhythms alive inside her. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Today's show is brought to you by director Tracy Cotter and engineer Dan Crafton. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I'd like to say thanks to everyone who watched the start of this show on Facebook Live Video. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the show. Please comment on our VOA Now Facebook page. Tell us what you think and where you're watching from. You can also find me on Twitter. I am at Michael_Lippin. We'll see you later.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
March 8th is International Women's Day, celebrated by the United Nations since 1975 and adopted by a UN resolution in 1977 as United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. It is a day to reflect on women's progress, call for further change, and acknowledge the courage and determination of women working for gender equality around the world. It is also an opportunity to raise awareness about the struggles of women and girls the world over. Struggles for education, for equality before the law, for access to basic services that men take for granted, such as access to banking or training, and adult education. In too many cases, women struggle for basic respect, and in the worst cases, they struggle to be seen not as the property of anyone, but as a free and independent person. The fact is that although women and girls have made great strides in the past 41 years, they still have a long way to go. Nowhere in the world can women claim to have all the same rights and opportunities as men. The majority of the world's poorest people are women, and their work is less valued. They receive 30 to 40% less pay than men for doing the same work. Their lack of economic power sometimes translates to powerlessness in other aspects of their lives as well, where they disproportionately suffer from gender-based violence. That is why this year's theme is Planet 50-50 by 2030, Step It Up for Gender Equality. A part of the United Nations 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, it is an all-out push to implement a number of United Nations commitments on gender equality, women's empowerment, and women's human rights. This includes goals such as ending all forms of discrimination against women and girls everywhere, eliminating all forms of violence against women and girls, stopping all practices specifically harmful to girls, such as child, early and forced marriage, and female genital mutilation, and ensuring that all girls and boys receive a quality primary and secondary education. Any society hoping to flourish must begin by empowering its women and by promoting for them the same rights that men already enjoy. On International Women's Day, we celebrate and honor women and girls and commit ourselves to making the world a place where women and girls are not excluded or marginalized, but are free to realize their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.